This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 142 was recorded a day early this week on Wednesday, November 21st, 2018, due to the Thanksgiving holiday. I'm Eric Townsend. Price action in gold has been perplexing us since October 11th, so we're bringing CPM Group founder Jeffrey Christian in as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from the outlook for gold and silver to the gold-silver ratio, which has gotten a lot of attention recently, to the outlooks for platinum and palladium. The crude oil market has everyone's attention, so we're also bringing Art Berman back for a special follow-up appearance in our post-game segment after the feature interview. Regular listeners will recall that we had Art on the program at the end of September when he observed that oil prices had moved too high and predicted a significant correction to the downside was in the cards. But not even Art was expecting this significant of a correction to the downside, with WTI testing levels more than 30% off of their recent highs this week. We'll be asking Art whether this move is over or if there's more downside still to come.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's talk this S&P 500, because last week I was fishing for a short-term swing low, looking for it to follow through, but this selling is relentless. I certainly want to give my opinion on this, but what's your take, first of all, on the S&P here?
Well, what I've been feeling up through this morning when we got a little bit of a bounce was, wow, you know, it just seems like at every turn that you're looking for which way the technicals might go, it ends up taking the bearish turn. And we haven't really seen, you know, the big signal would be a breakdown below 2600. We haven't seen that yet, but short of that, we've seen just about everything. And I think what turned it around, at least temporarily, and it doesn't seem to be holding as we're speaking late on Wednesday afternoon, was Wednesday morning around 6 a.m., a report came out which basically interpreted some of the Fed communications and got a lot of people's attention, basically projecting that maybe there's a dovish pivot in Fed policy. And if they raise rates in December, perhaps it'll be the last time that they raise rates, or maybe just one more after that. But very soon in the spring, they will be reversing out of this tightening cycle. Now, I should mention that's exactly what Keith McCullough predicted last week on this program. But it seems like now everybody is on to that particular narrative. At least they were this morning. That was resulting in a bounce. And my feeling and what my plan was to say on the show today, Patrick, is, okay, the bounce is on, but this thing has got to follow through, because if it doesn't, I think we're in real trouble in this equity market. Well, it's only half a day later, and as far as I can see, it's not following through. We haven't moved to new lower lows below yesterday's close, but we're not much above it. I think the really key levels to watch are going to be 2,600, the recent low. If we take that out, then 2,500, which is going to be the low from back in February, is going to be absolutely critical. My instinct, though, just my spidey senses, Patrick, are telling me something's wrong here. It feels to me like this market is about to break, and maybe break big time. I've been saying for several weeks, okay, maybe there's, you know, this is the point where we should see that bounce. We're not seeing that bounce. How do you see it?
You're absolutely right. You know, when last week we saw that turn that came in on the Thursday and started to rally, those are the types of triggers that usually would bring in the buy on dip traders, and then we'd see bullish follow through. It certainly was a reasonable place to test whether the upside had any meat on the bone. But what we have seen here is just systematic distribution. The interesting part is that really you could define October sort of as this imbalance through CTA and very large dealer gamma exposures and all of this kind of selling that was driven by liquidity coming just in this big wave or surge. But this selling is far more systematic, almost like those discretionary managers are being forced to rebalance everything, and they're just hitting the market over and over again. And we're seeing that no technical levels are spurring these buyers to come back in with any velocity or any type of a meaningful pop on the upside. side. That makes it rather dangerous. As we approach this previous low at 2600, it truly is a line in the sand. If you look using that chart book that we looked at many weeks ago, where I kind of drew on a roadmap of the what ifs. What if this was like the Jamie Dimon bottom? What if this was like back in February? Or what if this was like 2007? Well, this is actually tracking like 2007. And if it was to continue, and I don't want to say this is a forecast, but if it continued to kind of go down that path, the next move is a break of 2600 that could see another 100 to 200 S&P points on the downside if it was to continue down that same kind of a roadmap. Now, that's why that 2600 level is going to be so important to watch. I think there's a whole wave of new selling because that would be a fresh new low for the year, and that would really start to solidify that 2018, in fact, was one very big topping formation. Let's see if that plays out that way. Nonetheless, let's move on to the US dollar, because similarly, the US dollar has all these little reasons to try to start to sell. But every time the dollar seems to drop, the buyers come back and drive it higher. The dollar seems to have some sort of motivation to go higher. We haven't broken that 97.50 area where the previous highs have been, but it just feels like the dollar wants to go higher here. What's your take on the dollar?
Well, I think it does want to go higher, and the resistance now is that dovish pivot narrative that so many people are talking about. Certainly, a lot of what's been driving this dollar rally has been the Fed's hiking cycle. If you believe that the Fed hiking cycle is ending, that really brings question to how much more strength there is left in the dollar rally. And I think that's exactly what the issue is that's affecting the market. And of course, since we spoke to you last week, several banks have recommended short dollar exposure. And, you know, regardless of whether they're right or wrong, those recommendations carry weight. People follow them. They take them seriously. And that results in positioning. The thing is, even as people were putting that positioning on, knocking the dollar down, it started to show some resilience back to the upside this afternoon. So I think we're dealing with a lot of news-driven resistance, but the market still seems to be trying to push through it. And I continue to think at this point, my view is there's reason to question this, particularly if this narrative takes hold that the Fed is done tightening. That could change the game. But short of outright confirmation of that, I think the dollar still wants to move higher.
Eric, let's move on to crude oil. What happened with the numbers this week?
Well, what we saw was on Tuesday a really dramatic sell-off, and I think what brought this about was there was talk on Monday of, okay, look, everybody don't panic. OPEC is going to come to the rescue. They're going to cut production. It's going to be great. There was indecision from Russia on Tuesday morning about whether or not they would participate in a production cut, and that really drove the selling, pushed us right down to test the 200-week moving average at 52.80. Really just exactly to the tick. I think it was right within a penny of that 52.80, which is where that moving average is. And by the way, I've got a chart of just about every imaginable moving average. There's none left after that below it. All the other moving averages are higher. So we don't have any more moving averages to clear if we break down below 52.80, which is where the 200-week is right now. API unexpectedly reported a drawdown in inventory on Tuesday afternoon. But then when the EIA report came out, it was a great big 4.9 million barrel build on inventory. Now, that should have been pretty darn bearish, especially after expectations were set for a draw by API. But it didn't really result. It was a very immediate down spike in prices. It didn't last more than about 20 minutes. Meanwhile, Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down a de minimis 116,000 barrels. Gasoline, a reasonably significant drawdown, 1.3 million barrels. That's probably the only real bullish data in the inventory. Distillates, a de minimis 77,000 barrel drawdown. So there was a pretty significant build in crude oil. It sent prices straight down. They only lasted down for about 20 minutes, and we started rallying higher. And as soon as I saw that, Patrick, I knew what was going on, because that big, big sell-off on Tuesday had widened the five-day gap, the difference between the closing price and the five-day moving average, to more than $3. And it's extremely uncommon not to see at least some kind of retracement then. So as soon as I saw the market starting to rally today after inventory and to take out the pre-inventory numbers to the upside, I said, okay, we're headed for the five-day moving average. No doubt in my mind, that's exactly almost to the tick where we went. Sure enough, as we hit it, we traded right back down to where we started again. Not lower numbers, but still, it looks to me like we had the retrace to the five-day moving average, closing that five-day gap, and setting the stage, possibly, for there to be more selling. Now, of course, we've got a holiday weekend. Friday is usually an up day for crude oil. It remains to be seen what happens, but I don't think that it's fair to say the bottom is in yet. It could be. There's a lot of reason to think. There have been signs of exhaustion, and certainly we hit a key target right on to the penny to that 200-week moving average. Doesn't mean it has to hold, though. So I think this jury's a little bit out, but I'm very open to the possibility that there could still be more downside in this market, especially the way the five-day moving average was so firmly rejected this afternoon. Remains to be seen what happens over the next several days. Meanwhile, I want to get Art Berman back onto the program because his call was so prescient when we had him on in September, saying that the market was too high, needed to move lower. Well, he got his wish, didn't he? It's definitely lower. The question now that I want to ask Art is, okay, it's much lower. Did you expect it to go this much lower? And from here, do we expect more upside or downside? And what comes next? So we'll get Art with us in the postgame segment after the feature interview.
All right, moving on, Eric. The gold price is trading around $1,226 right now. What's your take on gold here?
Well, I want to save most of the gold discussion for our feature interview with Jeff Christian because that's his specialty and he certainly knows a lot more than I do about it. I guess I would just say that we're still trading opposite the dollar. It seems like whatever crazy move started on October 11th didn't really follow through to the upside. I want to ask Jeff what he thinks was driving that and why it hasn't followed through. So let's save the rest for the feature interview.
All right, let's move on to the 10-year yields. We were obviously as high as 3.25. We're now around 3.05 on the yield. What's your take here?
Patrick, this decisive move down below 3.10 is extremely significant in my mind because it marks that level that should have held as support if we were to believe in this breakout that so many people were predicting that we were headed into a secular bear market in bonds from here. It should have held. It hasn't held. Now, it's easy to say, wait a minute now. The Fed dovish pivot narrative could easily explain that. Maybe it's a temporary move back below 310 and it's not to be taken seriously. And we haven't gone below 305, which was one of those key levels. Different people were using different levels as the critical level. Some said 310, some said 305. Hasn't really gone below 305 yet. Maybe it's not all over. So I think it's a little bit too early to call, but it feels to me like something's up. If we see follow through and we take out 305 to the downside and we see closing prints for a couple of days below 305, that really opens the door in my mind to the possibility that this is an extremely, extremely bullish for price, meaning bearish for yield, yields moving lower from here, signal. Because as you know, in technical analysis, when you see a decisive breakout that later proves itself to have been a false breakout, that usually is a very, very strong signal in the opposite direction. The thing is, we haven't really seen it prove itself to be a false breakout yet. It looks like that may be beginning. The guy I really want to ask about this is Julian Brigden, because he predicted this move in the 10-year months before it happened. He's been the guy that has had the best view on this market, and he's also watching a lot of longer-term signals, particularly what's going on with the 30-year and the 100-month moving average. So let's do what we can and see if we can get Julian on before the end of the year in order to go deeper on this subject. But I think we could be on the cusp of something really, really significant if yields continue to drop lower from here.
Now, we have a quick housekeeping announcement to make here. Eric, what's up?
Well, we had quite a few emails. We were inundated, actually, because the HedgEye offer was so compelling. So many people wanted it. And I'm not ever, Patrick, don't worry, I would never call you out on the air in front of all of our listeners and say that you were the one that forgot to put the links into the Research Roundup email last week. I would never, ever do that. So So let me just get back to the PSA here. What was I saying? Oh, yes. So due to unknown technical difficulties that we are unable to diagnose, somehow those links didn't make it into last week's research roundup. They're still there. We called our friends at HedgeEye and asked them to extend that offer because it was our mistake. So if you were interested and unable to find the links last week, we did actually send out another email, but for some reason we got lots of people who didn't get that one either. So this week's research roundup email has the links for the HedgeEye All Access Pass. So it's an extra $100 off of their already super low price, and they said they would extend that offer through this week in order to accommodate our listeners. And don't blame Patrick personally for his egregious error. It's not his fault.
On that note, thanks for the market update, Eric. And this week's featured interview guest is Jeffrey Christian from the CPM Group. Eric's interview with Jeffrey is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is CPM Group founder Jeffrey Christian, very well known as a precious metals expert. Jeff, I want to start with this story in gold. I've been watching this market for months and months. It seemed to me like there wasn't a whole lot of a story to tell. It was inverse of the dollar, as you would expect. But then on October 11th, we saw gold and the dollar move up on the same day, and they moved up big in both the dollar and gold. And I think that's perplexed a lot of people. A whole bunch of conspiracy theorists said, okay, that means that the secret Chinese manipulation is over and we're about to go to 2000. But, you know, a couple weeks went by and things have settled down and we're starting to trade lower again. So do you have any explanation of what changed around the 11th of October and how that's played into markets?
Yes. As you know, I sort of ignore the conspiracy theories and the conspiracy theorists. And what we thought we were watching in the middle of October was that you had a stock market which was very nervous. You were 2 weeks before the election, and there were all kinds of jockeying about what was going to happen too in the election in terms of control of the Congress and also its implication for the economy. And then you had the Jamal Khashoggi murder. And, you know, everybody except Donald Trump in the world pretty much immediately knew that the Saudi government had killed this guy in its embassy and scuttled the body out somehow. And there was a lot of call about, you know, what are we going to do about sanctions against Saudi Arabia, et cetera. And the Saudi response was, hey, if you're going to make a big deal out of the fact that we killed this guy, we will cut back supply of oil, we will jack up the oil price, and we'll throw the world into a major recession or depression. And you saw the stock market come off sharply. You saw gold and the dollar both rise. Now, there are people, and I know you pay a lot of attention to the relationship between gold and the dollar, and we pay some attention to it, but the correlation is not as strong as a lot of people think. And there are times when you see a financial or political crisis and people rush to the dollar, and there are times when they race to gold, and there are times right when they raced to the dollar and gold. And I think what you saw October 11th and for a week or so after that was people were racing to both the dollar and to gold because there was a serious concern. There's an ongoing concern that we might go into a recession 2019, 2020. Some people are talking about a very big potential recession at that time. And I think that you saw a lot of people very much concerned that the Saudis would follow through on that threat, and that you could see what has been a very top-heavy stock market with prone to, you know, 400, 500, 600-point down days, in fact, fall much, much more significantly, and economic conditions turn much more severe. So our take was that that's what you were seeing. After a week or two, everything kind of quieted down on the Jamal Khashoggi murder and the concerns that the world would do something that would cause the Saudis to trigger a recession. The stock market dusted itself off for a few weeks, and gold came back off. Now the stock market's down again, and gold's back up.
So we're starting to see a pattern here of gold doing what it used to do, which is being a safety trade asset when other things are wrong. How does this fit into your overall big picture view of where other markets are headed, and particularly the outlook for gold in coming months and years?
our view for most of 2018 was that 2018 would be a relatively quiet year. Gold has been weaker than we thought it would be. We didn't necessarily see it rising or rising significantly in 2018. Our expectation has been that it would rise more strongly in 2019 and going forward, and that you'd see a relatively strong market this year, partly due to tax cuts, partly due to stock buybacks, and partly due to a relatively healthy economy, which actually has been healthier in the United States, China, Europe, and other parts of the world than a lot of people thought it would be at the beginning of 2018. So the gold price has been kind of bumping along. Our expectation is that the rest of this year, you continue to see gold kind of bump along, you know, 1200, 1210 on the downside, and maybe 1240, 1250 on the upside. But that when you get into the first quarter of 2019, a lot of the economic, financial, and political issues that stimulate investment interest or lack of interest in gold will become more positive for gold and more hostile for stocks and bonds, and that you could see the gold price start to move back higher over the course of 2019 and 2020.
And what about silver? What's your outlook there?
Our outlook on silver is similar. We're a little bit less optimistic about silver, and we have some concerns about it. You know, the way we interpret what's going on in the market is that investors around the world see gold as quasi-money, a financial asset, a safe haven. And a lot of investors around the world see silver that way, but fewer than see gold that way. And I think that one of the things you've seen over the last couple of years is that investors have focused their residual interest in precious metals has been focused on gold at the expense of silver. You've seen investment demand come down for both of them, but you have seen weaker investment demand patterns in silver than gold. And so silver has suffered at the hands of those investors. We think it'll turn around, but it's probably going to be a little bit more muted of a response than what you would expect to see in gold.
Now, I'm very curious about that in particular, because when you say you're less optimistic about silver, something a lot of people have been talking about lately and which you've written about recently, we do have your writing on the gold-silver ratio linked for our listeners in the Research Roundup email. A lot of people are saying, hey, we're past 80 to 1 now on the gold-silver ratio. Historically, that's got to mean that silver is undervalued relative to gold, but you're saying you think that silver might get even more undervalued, if I hear you correctly. Why are you not concerned with this historical level of 80 to 1 that so many people seem to be convinced is an indication that it is time for silver to appreciate relative to gold?
Well, we are concerned. Well, we are paying attention to it. But I think that there is some misstatements being made about the importance of 80 to 1. It is true that several times in recent years, or recent decades, you've seen the gold-silver ratio get to 80 to 1 and then it falls back down. But there was a very important period from 1990 through 1993 where the ratio got to 80 to 1 and then it went to 100 to 1. And it was above 80 to 1 for almost 4 years there. So I think that, and if you look at what was going on in the gold and silver markets in that period, you really go back to like 1988 to 1994, there are cautionary tales for the current period in what was going on in the silver market in that period. And that was a period where a lot of investors were abandoning silver. They were selling their silver. They weren't buying as much silver as they had in the first half of the 1980s. And you saw the silver price come down and trade down as low as 351, 352 for about 4 years there before it started to rise. So I think that the fact that silver is undervalued relative to gold is important. But just because it's at 80 to 1 doesn't mean that it's going to go to 50 to 1 or 60 to 1 on short order, because in a similar time and similar silver market conditions to what we're seeing now, silver went from 80 to 1 to 100 to 1, and it took 4 years before it got south of 80 to 1. So, we're just very cautious about being overly optimistic on silver prices solely because the ratio is at 80-1, because I don't think there is really any magic other than self-fulfilling prophecies with that 80-1 number.
You know, it's very interesting to me because I've seen so many pieces in the last couple of weeks about this 80-1 ratio, and every single one of them has said clearly this can only mean one thing, which is that silver is undervalued and about to go up. And I kind of think, wait a minute, why wouldn't it mean that gold is overvalued and about to go down? And I guess it's because the people that are metals dealers are the ones that are writing most of these articles. But it really does beg an important question in my mind, which is, if, let's say this, as you say, it's very possible we could go from 80-1 to 100-1. But let's suppose that we do see that 80-1 historical norm rule play out to where that ratio starts to come down. Do you think that there's a scenario there where maybe silver is actually presaging or forecasting an outlook for gold to move down substantially from here before it eventually moves higher? Because certainly we've seen an uptrend in the U.S. dollar.
You make a very good point. Yeah, you know, first off, you're talking about a ratio, and there are people who imbue sort of mystic qualities to this ratio that don't really exist. But you make a very good point that it's a ratio dividing the price of one asset versus the other, and that ratio can change because they're both falling, or one's falling and one's rising, or they're both rising at different paces. You know, and you have to sort of go back in history, and you have to say, well, you know, when the ratio has risen in the past, what was going on? And, you know, in the case of what you're saying, when the ratio has come off, what was going on? And in the case of like early 1988, you saw the gold ratio get close to 80-1, and then it fell back to about 57-1. And that was because the gold price was falling. And it was falling more rapidly than was the silver price, because you had been in a period, 1986, 1987, into January of 1988, where the gold price had risen very sharply on the expectations of a recession. You had the Black Thursday, I think it was called, or Black Monday, where the stock market fell very sharply in October of 1987. And a lot of people were concerned that the world was going into a recession, and gold went from, you know, $400 to $500 an ounce, and then it came back off. So that ratio improved not because the silver price was rising, but because the gold price was falling faster than the silver price was. And whether or not the silver market is signaling that with gold really depends on what you think about the fundamentals and the investment demand trends in gold and silver. Our view is that at this point, gold and silver investment demand probably are bottoming out, and that what you will see going forward, 2019-2020, it will be stronger investment demand for silver and stronger demand for investment demand for gold, predicated on the economic environment that we see coming out and going forward from here. If the economic environment and the stock market and the dollar are stronger than we expect in 2019-2020, then you could see a further ratcheting down of investment demand for both gold and silver, and you could see that ratio move upward, you know, toward 100-1 before you saw the ratio reverse and fall. But, you know, we don't predicate our price views on our views of the ratio. We predicate our views of the ratio on our price views, and the price views are built on a macroeconomic base and a microeconomic analysis of the individual gold and silver markets.
Well, let's talk about those outlooks and those markets a little bit more, because you said that from an investment demand standpoint, you thought that maybe we were starting to bottom in terms of investment demand. What's been pushing that investment demand down in the first place? Why is it going down, and what's going to cause it to turn around and start going back up again?
Yeah, well, first, let's quantify it. You know, investment demand was about 40 million ounces in 2011 for gold, net physical demand for gold in 2011. And it was about 37.5 million ounces in 2012. But you started seeing large gross sales and large gross purchases at that time. And then, you know, over the last couple of years, it's been 19 million ounces estimated investment demand in 2017, 20 million ounces this year. Right. And it's interesting because we've seen big changes in the nature of investment demand for gold and for silver. And in both markets, what you've seen is large reductions in the amount of gold and silver being bought by people who expect economic chaos. You know, people who buy gold and silver because the world's going to collapse, the world financial system's going to collapse, the dollar's going to collapse, Europe's going to collapse, whatever it is. And a lot of those people have been crying in their beer because the world hasn't collapsed and gold prices haven't risen sharply and nor have silver prices. And what we've seen over the last 2-3 years now is that those long-term buy and hold investors who bought based on economic chaos fears have been buying less metal. And in fact, some of them have been selling and others have been dying and their estates have been selling. But at the same time, that's been partially offset by a new wave of investors, many of whom were never in gold and silver before, and they're more in gold than silver. And these are more value investors and trend followers. And these are people who are saying, okay, the stock market's very high, interest rates are starting to rise, the economy has been much better than a lot of people expected, it's probably peaking in 2018. The gold price and the silver price, meanwhile, have been hammered down. So as a value investor and a relative value investor, I'm looking at a stock market that's very top-heavy. I've made a lot of money in it over the last several years. It's probably time to lighten up some of my stock and bond holdings and put some of that money into gold and to silver, because these things look like longer term, they're probably more likely to rise than to decline. Now, in the last few months, you've seen these trend followers and value investors joined by some people buying gold and silver out of concerns about economic and political trends, not only in the United States, but in England and in other parts of the world. That all comes together into what I was talking about earlier is, you know, we think that we're probably pretty much at the bottom for gold and silver investment demand and consequently prices. If you see a much rosier world, then you could see some of that investment demand disappear again and the prices have downside exposure. Our expectation is that the world's not going to be rosier in 2019. It's going to be less rosy. Our expectation is that the $1.2 trillion in stock buybacks that you saw this year, mostly fueled by tax cuts, are a one-time event that won't be repeated in 2019. And as a consequence, the stock market will look more vulnerable. Economic growth will be a little bit weaker or much more weaker than it was this year, and that the tide could turn on the stock market, the economy, and in fact also the U.S. dollar. And all of that could provide a base for gold and silver around, you know, $1,200, $1,180 for gold and around $14 for silver, at which point investors would, you know, maybe step up to the plate and start buying more again.
Let's touch on cryptocurrencies in the perspective of how they have affected the precious metals market. For a while, when this speculative mania in digital currency or cryptocurrency tokens was really in its heyday in the end of 2017, you saw all kinds of people saying, you know, gold is dead, crypto is the new gold, that's it. And it seemed like that was hurting gold prices. Now that we see crypto crashing in many respects, or certainly selling off, and we're seeing a reversal of that, maybe the downside of that speculative mania, I would have thought that that would have brought more investment back into gold, but it seems like we're not really seeing that strength there. So how do you perceive the effect that cryptocurrency is having on precious metals markets?
Well, as you may recall, we probably talked a year ago, and I was saying cryptocurrencies are not distracting investors from gold. What was distracting investors from gold was the stock market. And we were poo-pooing the importance of cryptocurrencies as a negative factor on gold. If you look at it, you've got a $70 trillion global stock market, 42%, 45% of which is U.S. stocks. You have quadrillions of dollars in stock derivatives. You have this enormous amount of money that is focusing on stocks and stocks. Then you have a multi-trillion dollar gold market, and then you have a cryptocurrency market, which in total was like less than $1 trillion. So our view was that gold was weak, not because people were buying cryptocurrencies instead of gold, but that gold was weak because they were buying stocks instead of gold. So the gyrations and the collapse of the cryptocurrencies and the realization that they were really pet rocks, they were the antithesis of gold, has had a very limited positive effect on gold because it's the backwash of what we saw as a very limited negative effect on gold. And if you want to see a positive effect on gold, wait for the stock market to fall significantly, and then you'll see money moving into gold. Because cryptocurrencies were always sort of like a bad joke to some of us. And if you wanted to be nice to them, you could say it's a very small marginal market that has a marginal effect on much larger markets. So we didn't think that cryptos were siphoning off a lot of money from gold. And with the realization that cryptos are the antithesis of gold, the ultimate Ponzi scheme, you haven't necessarily seen a positive effect on gold.
It seems like a lot of your message, Jeff, is really that what we can expect from gold has a lot to do with the things it does depend on, which I guess are the dollar and the stock market. So why don't you share with us your outlook for the dollar and the stock market and how that is going to play in, as well as politics for that matter, into where you think the gold market, you think it's headed higher eventually, but it sounds like not right away.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the stock market because, you know, there have been various economic analyses by Sober and by the Economist who have indicated that a lot of the strength in the U.S. dollar has in fact reflected the strength in the stock market. And that what you're really seeing is a lot of investors around the world saying, okay, the U.S. economy is better off than other economies. The interest rates are rising and the differential between U.S. treasuries and other sovereign bonds is expanding. And the stock market in the United States is doing much better than the rest of the world. So they've been buying dollars in order to buy into the U.S. stock market and U.S. assets. So a lot of it comes down to the stock market. And then you go back to the stock market and say, well, why has the stock market been rising? Well, it's been rising primarily because of the big fillip of tax cuts this year and because of the stock buybacks. And it's very interesting because people, you know, I made this point someplace last week and somebody said, yeah, well, you know, earnings per share are up. And I said, right, because the number of shares are down. You know, and what you have to really look is, you know, what are corporate earnings doing, not earnings per share? And corporate earnings are lagging earnings per share because of the stock buyback. You have a U.S. industrial corporate base that has been decapitalizing for many, many years now. You know, if you look at the tax cuts, U.S. corporations get something like $1.5 trillion in additional revenue this year from tax cuts and tax rebates and tax paybacks and stuff. And of that, something like $1.1 or $1.2 trillion went into stock buybacks, and about $300 or $400 billion went into actual capital investment in the companies. These are companies that are decapitalizing. That's not good for the U.S. economy in the long run. It's good for stock market investors in the short run because they're getting their cash out. And it makes the stock market stronger. It makes stock prices rise because there are dollars chasing fewer number of shares. And it makes the stock market look that much healthier. And, you know, one of the things that you'll hear sober economists say over and over again is the stock market is not a presage of economic conditions. Or, as you know, my old boss at Goldman Sachs, Leon Cooperman, used to say, the stock market has predicted 15 of the last 4 recessions. You know, it's not necessarily a good measure. So just because the stock market's rising doesn't mean that the U.S. economy and U.S. industry and U.S. corporations are doing well. There's a lot of stuff that's going on that is goosing the stock market that's not necessarily good for the gander of the U.S. economy, if I can mix my metaphors and play on words there. So our expectation is the stock market's probably peaking if it hasn't already peaked. There are a lot of people talking about 30, 40, 50% decline in the stock market at some point. We think that will happen. It may not happen in 2019, 2020, It may not happen until 2023 or 2024, but we do think that the U.S. economy and the U.S. stock market are both headed for harder times. 19 and 20 may be a soft landing, but it's probably you're not going to see further increases in the stock market. You do have a lot of political things that are going to be happening starting in the first quarter of 2019 that could have negative implications for foreign investors' attitudes toward investing more in the United States. So you could see the dollar peak and maybe come off a little bit. It's not going to come off a lot because the U.S. economy still has head and shoulders above other economies. But you probably will see a weaker stock market, a weaker dollar, and a weaker economy, all of which presage better gold prices because investors will be looking to protect some of their assets from those negative consequences.
Let's talk a little bit more about what could happen in the stock market. And I agree with you that the tops are probably in or coming if they're not already in. Let's suppose, though, that we do get another really big downside event in the stock market, which some people are predicting. I'm not necessarily predicting that, but let's cover that case. Because what a lot of people have pointed out is they've said, hey, you know, everybody wants to think stock market crash, gold is your safety trade. But if you look at what happened in 2008, at first, gold was the safety trade. Gold was up at the beginning of the great financial crisis. But once things really got rolling, all correlations went to one. Everybody was selling their gold along with everything else. And gold sold off not as heavily as stocks, but it sold off dramatically. It was not the right move at the beginning of the financial crisis to be getting into gold. If anything, you wanted to wait for it to bottom considerably after the stock market started selling off. Is that a one-time event, or is there a possibility again that if the stock market were to start selling off, that you might see a temporary move up in gold, but then gold might turn and follow stocks down if we see a really big sell-off?
Well, I think it plays the other way around. I mean, you know, one of the things about gold is it has multiple functions for investors. And one of the functions it serves is to protect the value of wealth and portfolios from economic problems. But another attribute of gold is that it's a great liquidity source in times of crisis. And what you saw in 2008, late 2008, early 2009, was massive liquidation of gold by people who needed money fast. The gold price then turned itself around and went to new highs, significantly newer highs, significantly faster than the stock market. So, you know, the gold market and the stock market both fell in the final 4 months of 2008 and into 2009. But, you know, where gold prices got down to like $900, they went to $1,900 by 2011. And the stock market, to make that kind of increase, took 10 years. So I think that what you could expect, and I'll get back, there's several things to pay attention to. I think what you could expect is if you saw a major rout in the stock market, gold prices could weaken initially because of that turning to gold holdings for liquidity to meet margin calls and credit requirements, which is a traditional thing. We saw it in 2008, but we saw it in other years too. We've seen it in other recessions and other downturns, including 2000, 2001. So that's not all that surprising to see, you know, but then I think gold dusts itself off. Now, you're right in saying buying gold when the house is on fire doesn't make sense. You buy the gold as an insurance policy before the house gets on fire. If you see that your son is a pyromaniac and he's playing with matches late at night, you buy the gold before he burns the house down. Once the house is on fire, buying gold is not going to help you. And I think you're seeing that with these guys I was talking about earlier, the trend followers and the value investors who are saying, look, you know, this is a good time to be loading up with gold. And we haven't talked about central banks, but that's exactly what central banks are doing this year. They're taking the opportunity of lower prices to buy more gold than they had been in the past or in the recent past. So that's a trend there. Now, there's another thing to pay attention to with the stock market. The stock market has repeatedly dropped 30, 40, 50%. It did that in 2000, 2001. It did it in 2008, 2009. I think it did it probably in 1990 and maybe in 1987. I'm not sure what the percent decline was. But what you've seen in the stock market, which is very important for long-term investors, 1987, major stock market decline, and within 6 months, the stock market was back at new highs. 2000, major stock market decline, like 40-some-odd percent in the NICE and like 80% in the NASDAQ, and it took about 4 years to get back to where they had been before the sell-off. 2008, 2009, major decline in the stock market, and it really took them about 8 or 9 years to get back to their previous highs. So what you're seeing is that, yes, the stock market does recover, but over the last several decades, those recoveries have taken longer and longer to materialize and get back to those previous highs. And I think that's a very scary issue for long-term investors, because what it tells you is that when your stockbroker says, oh, yeah, the stock market falls, but it always springs back, it's taking longer and longer to spring back. And that reflects structural changes in the economy as well as in the financial markets. So I think that that's a very cautionary issue for stock market investors and stock investors. And it's probably more positive for gold because there are any number of people who see it.
Jeff, I'd like to come back to something that you said earlier in this interview, because so many people in the gold market particularly are obsessed with one intermarket relationship or another. There's been a lot of people that have written about the relationship between gold and the Japanese yen. Recently, we've seen a stronger correlation with the Chinese yuan. And I'm sure there's lots of others. Everybody's got some explanation as to what the secret sauce is for figuring out through some intermarket relationship what gold's going to do next. But I think you said earlier you almost ignore intermarket correlations at CPM Group. What's going on there? It sounds like you don't believe that they have the value that a lot of other people do. Please elaborate.
Well, I think markets are interrelated, but the relationships are much more complex than a lot of people want to admit. So, you know, our view is that real interest rates are the key to the valuation of gold and everything else in the world. But if you look at the correlation between real gold price changes and real interest rate changes, it's zero over time. It really is zero over time. And when we look at, say, for example, the relationship between interest rates and gold, we say, okay, interest rates are rising now. Why are they rising? Because why they're rising is probably more important in determining what's going to happen to gold than the fact that they're rising. And also, what levels are they at? Because that's clearly very important. Rising interest rates from negative 2% real rates to positive 4% real interest rates, i.e., you know, positive 6 to 7% nominal rates, generally speaking, don't have a negative effect on gold prices. It's only when you see real interest rates at 5 or 6 or 7% that you start seeing a really high negative correlation between gold price changes and interest rate changes. Now, note that I'm talking about apples to apples, changes in the gold price versus changes in the interest rate price, right? People will look at the T-bill rate versus the gold price, and that's apples to oranges. And then they come up with a higher ratio, but that's bad statistics. So it's not that we don't think these things are interrelated. We just think that they change. If you look at the relationship between, say, gold and the dollar, and again, you got to look at percent changes in the real gold prices and percent changes in the real dollar, inflation-adjusted dollar. If you go back to 1970, really the start of the free gold market, through last year, the negative correlation between gold and the dollar is 34%. Interestingly, if you look at 1978 to 1982, the relationship was a positive 6%. And that goes back to something I was saying earlier, which is you can have times, remember 1978 to 1980, 14% inflation, 21% interest rates, U.S. hostages in Iran, Soviet troops invading Afghanistan, a quadrupling of oil prices. We moved into what was then the biggest recession in the post-war period. You can have a period of time where people want the dollar and they want gold, and you can have a positive correlation. You know, so we always break it down and we say, you know, these markets are interrelated, but what you really want to know is why is the dollar rising or falling, and what does that have to do with the gold price outlook. Why is the stock market rising or falling? Why are interest rates rising or falling? Because that's really more important. You know, you can look at T-bills and you can say, okay, 1970 to 2017, the relationship is zero. It's a perfect hedge for interest rates because there's no correlation. But you can pick out times like 1978, 82, again, that very critical period of time, where the correlation was negative 13%. And you could pick out times like 2008 to 2017 where the correlation was positive 2%. So what's important to us is not necessarily any ratio or relationship, but what's driving the changes in these alternate assets and alternate investments, because that's really what's going to determine whether or not investors are interested in gold or not.
Another phrase that I've heard you use before is when marketing replaced research. What are you talking about there with respect to accuracy of market data?
There's a discussion that it's really gone on for decades, but it's gotten to be more intense now in the last year or two in the gold, platinum, and silver markets. And people are looking at the integrity of statistics. And, you know, I've been doing precious metal statistics as an outside observer and an independent advisor since the late 1970s. And we are violently independent. But over the last couple decades, what you saw was the rise of people who provide gold, silver, platinum supply demand statistics because they're marketing gold, silver, platinum group metals. And they have not necessarily done as good a job as independent research people have done. And in some cases, it's just sloppiness, or they don't have the contacts, or they don't have the will to do as good a job. But in some cases, I think you have to say, and I know that you can say this because I've heard the conversations, I've been party to the conversations, people want to have numbers that are bullish because they're in the business of marketing these metals. So, for example, if you look at any of these metals, one of the things that happened starting around the early 1990s was marketeers started including investment demand with fabrication demand in their supply-demand balances. Now, you know, commodities research 101 is that you take total supply and you subtract fabrication or consumption demand, depending on the commodity, and that gives you a surplus or a deficit. And you don't include investment demand with fabrication demand because investment demand is a completely different beast. It has different price drivers, different economic drivers. And when an investor buys a commodity, which is typically a precious metals because the other commodities don't do so well as physical investments, when an investor buys that physical commodity, he or she does not change its form. If a jeweler buys gold, he makes it into jewelry. If an electronics company buys gold, he makes it into electronics. If an investor buys gold, he keeps it in bar or coin form, and it can be resold at a moment's notice. So for those and other reasons, traditional economic research in commodities does not include investment demand with fabrication demand in calculating whether or not a market is in surplus or deficit. But starting in the 1990s, you started seeing people whose jobs, who were paid to provide statistics that were used to market gold, silver, and platinum to investors and others, include investment demand in with fabrication demand. And they were told that was wrong, and there were discussions in the early 1990s that this was wrong, but they continued to do it, and they continue to do it today. So, you know, we've had platinum producers, for example, who have retained us to talk about why is the platinum market so weak? Because I look at all these numbers and I see these massive deficits. Well, if you look at our platinum statistics, we've had massive surpluses because we're not fudging the data by including surrogates for investment demand in there. And if you take all these other guys' numbers and you say, okay, let's take out the investment demand figures and let's look at their supply-demand balances, just total supply, less fabrication demand, voila, their deficits turn into surpluses. And that's why you've got weak platinum prices. You have a platinum market that has been in a surplus for years. The marketeers keep going around talking about how it's been a deficit. The producers get into this really weird conversation where they say, the market's in a deficit and we don't understand why the price is so low. But at some point, investors will realize the market's in a deficit, and then they'll buy up the surplus and the price will rise. And you say, wait, you just said that the market was in a deficit. But now you're saying that investors have to buy up the surplus for the price to rise, which is exactly right. So you're sort of implying that you know that the market's not in a deficit. And they go, yeah, whatever. So we're seeing right now, because the producers are suffering, and they're suffering for a variety of reasons, we're seeing producers sort of say, what's wrong here? Why don't investors believe us when we tell them that our markets are in deficits? And the answer is because investors are smarter than you.
Jeff, we've been talking mostly about gold and silver. I want to touch on the other two popular precious metals before we leave, which, of course, are platinum and palladium, and just get your general outlook there, particularly palladium. I saw something in the news in the last week or so, supposedly palladium in backwardation, and, of course, there's always a conspiracy theory when there's backwardation that the world's coming to an end and there's going to be no more palladium forever or something. Is there anything real going on there, and what is your outlook more generally for platinum and palladium?
Well, palladium's in a relatively tight market. You've had large surpluses over the last several years, but they've largely disappeared. And really, the last 5 years or so, the palladium market has been pretty tight. You have rising fabrication demand, the use of palladium in auto catalysts, but also in electronics and other applications, too. And that's there. There's a lot of palladium in above-ground inventories, but the inventory holders see a tight market in terms of a current annual supply-demand balance, and so they're waiting to see how high the price will go. And that's primarily what you've got. So you've got a tight market. You've got strong fabrication demand. Most palladium is produced as a byproduct either of platinum or nickel, so you're not necessarily seeing producers race out to increase their palladium production. You are seeing slower shifts there. And investors who are saying, okay, I like palladium, so I'll buy it, or I like palladium, so I'm not going to sell any inventories until I see how high the price can get. And I think that that's really what's going on. Now, on top of that, you've had like spot issues. So the backwardation in palladium first emerged in May and June of 2017. And that was at a time when you had strong supply demand fundamentals for the NYMEX palladium futures contract going into the June delivery. But at the same time, you had a disruption in supply. You had about 3 tons of palladium that was delivered to an auto catalyst manufacturer that had too much oxygen or moisture in it. And so it had to be re-refined. And that meant that that auto company had to go back into the spot market and find 100,000 ounces of palladium. And that's when we tipped over into a backwardation. And once you get into that backwardation, then there are any number of participants. It's not a conspiracy. Anybody who's looking at their screen can say, wait a second, you know, you've got very high open interest on the NYMEX relative to reported and registered inventories. So I think that every time we get into this three-month cycle of delivery, you know, the active months are March, June, September and December, you could expect the palladium price to rise as the people who are short those active months have to buy them back and roll their positions forward. And that's been going on now for a year and a half. And it's probably going to continue a little while longer because it's a profitable trade. You don't have to conspire. You just have to understand how futures markets work and take a look at the data. And you can say, okay, this is probably a pretty good trade at this point. And so, you know, long-term, we like palladium. It's got a great future as fabrication demand. We think supply will be constrained by constraints on platinum and nickel production going forward. And you probably have a relatively tight market. You do have a lot of inventories out there, but if inventory holders think the price is going to rise further, they're not going to sell their inventories. And that's what you're seeing right now.
Jeff, as we close, we do have a couple of sample research notes from CPM Group linked in our Research Roundup email for our listeners' perusal. Tell them, in general, what products and services you offer at CPM Group.
Well, CPM Group actually has a new product line that we're rolling out now initially, and we hope to roll out more completely in the first quarter. We produce research reports and consulting services. So you can buy our annual gold, silver, platinum yearbooks. You can go to our website, which is cpmgroup.com, and buy those. We have monthly reports, precious metals advisory, base metals advisory. And most of our work is actually consulting, where companies will come to us or investors will come to us, and they'll ask us questions either about the nature of these markets or potential investments, either in the metals themselves or futures and option strategies. So we have a variety of consulting services across research, asset management, commodities management, investing type of things. The new product is that we're taking our short-term buy and sell recommendations, and we're building out with various internet platforms that we will sell these short-term trade recommendations, spot, futures, options, gold, silver, platinum, palladium. We'll sell them either as individual trade recommendations, or you can subscribe to them and get everything that we produce over the course of a month. We're starting to make the gold spot recommendations available in August on goldxapp.com. But then we're talking to a variety of other groups about rolling out the futures options and also spot recommendations for silver, platinum, and palladium. And we hope to be in a position where maybe that stuff starts to show up and be available to investors in January.
Well, Jeff, I want to thank you for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Jeffrey back onto the show. What I took away really was the comments that he made on intermarket relationships of gold. And what I have always noticed in the markets, because I love the study of intermarket relationships, but he's dead on that they're always changing. You know, I remember a period where the stock market seemed to hang on every single move in crude oil, and then that intermarket relationship stopped and it didn't work the same way it did in the past. And so it was interesting to see how those things evolved. But I really like this point generally that those intermarket relationships, while they're valuable, they're not consistent over time. What did you take away from it?
Well, I agree with you on that. And I think probably the way to think about that one is, you know, too many people want to know the answer to what is the secret intermarket, secret sauce for how to predict the gold market. And the real question is, what is gold trading in correlation with now? And to watch that and know that at some point that correlation is going to break down and it's not going to work anymore and it's going to correlate with something else. In this case, though, what I particularly took away from this interview was Jeff's comment about how research has been replaced with marketing. And I think it's more true in precious metals than anything else. And a perfect example is that gold-silver ratio. How many pieces can you find out there that say gold-silver ratio is at an extreme more than 80, and that can only mean one thing, which is that silver is undervalued? Well, why can't it mean that gold is overvalued? You know, how does that work? And the answer is because if you came to that conclusion, you wouldn't be buying anything from the people that are writing this stuff. So I think he's very right about how there's been a corruption of research with marketing and salesmanship.
All right, Eric, before we bring our Berman on, give us a quick update on what's going on with your book.
You know, Patrick, it's really amazed me. On one hand, all the Amazon reviews from people who actually read the book are all 5-star, and I've gotten a huge amount of positive feedback from people who read the book. But I've gotten more emails from people who didn't read the book who are angry in some cases that I wrote a crypto book. And it blows my mind that anybody could have listened to our post-game conversation last week and still thought I wrote a crypto book. So if you're disappointed that I wrote a crypto book, I didn't write a crypto book. The book is not about Bitcoin or blockchain. The book is about why digital currency technology over the next 20 to 30 years is going to completely change the world that we live in. As I predict in the book, I don't think cryptocurrency is going to play nearly as big of a role in that story as everybody in the crypto community is anticipating. So I certainly welcome critical feedback about the book, but the critical feedback that is about the fantasy that you have in your head about a book that I never wrote is kind of weird. It's creepy, really. So I hope if people are interested in the book that they'll read it. If they're not interested, that's fine too. I respect your choice, but please don't send me angry emails about a book that I never wrote. It's really kind of silly. In any event, though, the people that have read it seem to love it. So it's been quite interesting.
And just as a final comment, for those of you that actually did read the book, for a first-time author like Eric, it's really important to get those Amazon reviews. So if you enjoyed the book, please leave a review on Amazon. But Eric, I want to bring Art Berman into the conversation. How you doing, Art?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Now, Art, you sent us a fantastic chart book, and our listeners can find that attached in the Research Roundup email as well on the website. Now, Art, I want to ask you, what's going on in the oil markets? Like when you were on the show last time, you were came on and gave us a pretty bearish spin on it. But were you this bearish? Like this oil drop, wow, it's just been a straight line move from $77 on WTI down to, at the time when we're recording, we're trading near just around 53 handle. What's your take on this? What's going on, and how do you see this playing out from here?
Well, that's a great question, Patrick, and I think that the markets have characteristically, at least over the last couple of months, way overreacted. I suspect in the case of, you know, oil going to WTI going to 53, it's more than just oil markets that are involved in that reaction. I mean, there's some sort of a broader financial structural response going on here. But, you know, I mean, having said that, I don't think that oil is way too low. It's definitely on the extreme end of where I expected it. And you're absolutely right. The time of the reaction, the rate of the reaction was extreme. But again, that seems to be the way of things. I mean, we saw what I called in a recent post a panic attack, that the price of oil went up so quickly back in second half of September, very early part of October, for no apparent reason except fear factor of Iran shortages. And when it turned around, it did it in spades. We're seeing the same thing in the gas market right now. After months and months of being unfazed at super low inventory levels, all of a sudden the price of gas just went, you know, shooting up through the ceiling. And, you know, again, markets just seem to be overreacting. And I don't really have a good explanation for it because I'm not an expert on the mechanics of how markets work. But that is what I see.
Art, let's go ahead and jump into your slide deck, because on slide number 2, you've got the comparative inventory yield curve chart. And I just want to put my own little endorsement in for this. You've used this chart for a number of years. I remember at one point when they changed the rules so that they would legalize the export of crude oil, I got a little bit skeptical about some of your forecasts. I thought, boy, I don't know. It seems to me like maybe you're talking apples to oranges now that they've changed the rules. But sure enough, your yield curve chart was incredibly predictive. Your calls were spot on, and it's been amazing how well you've called this market. So congratulations. But my real question now is, where on the yield curve should we be based on your predictions here? First of all, for people who are maybe not familiar with this yield curve, explain what it is, but particularly tell us what it's predicting in terms of where the WTI price should be right now compared to the 53 handle that we're actually seeing as we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon.
Right, Eric. Well, slide 2, I think, says what needs to be understood about comparative inventory and the yield curve. So very quickly, let's just look at the slide on the right, which is sort of easier to understand. And this is just comparative inventory versus time. Comparative inventory being the amount of oil that's in storage compared to the five-year average for, in this case, with WTI, that particular week. And so what we see there is the red is a deficit that is less than the five-year average, and the yellow or the gold is a surplus. And so this particular graph just really nicely summarizes what happened with the oil price collapse in late 2014-15. You can see on the left-hand side of the graph, we go from red to yellow. It says November 2014, oil prices collapsed, comparative inventory built to a maximum in April 2015, then started working down, price of oil started going up. We went into a deficit in March of 2018. Oil prices got the highest they have in a number of years, and now we've built back to a surplus. So you take that same data, price, of course, being the blue on that right-hand curve, and just cross-plot WTI versus comparative inventory, and that's the graph on the left. And so putting it simply, we were on what, you know, the interpreted fit between there is what we call the yield curve, those points. So the red points are 2014 through the middle of 2017, and we were on a yield curve that suggested we crossed the five-year average at about $75. And then in about mid-2017, I started wondering, geez, you know, it looks like we're maybe heading off to a somewhat lower y-axis intercept. That's the blue points. And sure enough, that seems to be supported by the data. We intersected at about $70 or $65 rather, built to a maximum, and now we're going back basically in the other direction. So the answer to your question is, should we be at $53? And the answer is, depends on what the storage number is tomorrow, but my sense is that we've overshot, that the amount of storage addition that would be required to get us to 53 is probably not realistic. So the market is having a panic attack in the reverse direction as it did in late September, and now we're overshooting the yield curve, is my sense.
So Art, moving on slide three, we're talking more about this comparative inventory chart. What are we looking at here on chart three?
Patrick, slide three is looking at OECD, which is, of course, you know, developed nations of the world, minus the United States. And so one of the potential criticisms of comparative inventory is that I'm looking at U.S. oil. Maybe U.S. oil doesn't reflect the world, and that's a fair question, although, you know, experience tells me that as goes the U.S., so goes the world, but on oil at least. Nonetheless, what I've done is I've taken OECD oil storage, subtracted the U.S. out of it, and done exactly the same thing that I explained on slide number two. And the results are similar. Obviously, this is a monthly data versus WTI, which is weekly. But what we see there is a red trajectory intersecting the five-year average higher, a blue that began in the middle of 17. And what it shows us is that we've now built to above the five-year average. But I think the significance of the lower trajectory needs to be explained. And what that's saying is that the market has been expecting that a lower price is needed to keep supply in balance than previously. The why of that? Well, I think it's probably straightforward in that we now have oil from shale available to supply the market where conventional or OPEC or whatever, you know, whatever you want to think is the safety valve doesn't cut it. And of course, during the oil price collapse, everybody's costs went down for a variety of reasons. And so the market is simply saying, look, you know, we think that maybe only $60 or $65 is the mid-cycle price, as we call it, you know, where we intersect the five-year average. A lower price is all we need now to maintain supply. So that's been certainly a part of my argument why I thought that oil prices were too high recently. It's part of my argument now for why I think oil prices are a little bit too low at the moment. But this says that on the Brent side, which is what it's cross-plotted with here, OECD minus U.S. comparative inventory versus Brent, you know, the right price was maybe about, you know, $67 a barrel. So it's a little bit higher than WTI, but that's what that slide means.
So Art, how does this overall play out in terms of the world supply? How is this going to impact? Is there an increase in the overall world supply at this stage?
Patrick, that's exactly right. And so it seems while the oil markets were obsessing about what might happen with decreased supply as a result of sanctions on Iran and, oh, gee, you know, what if Venezuela gets worse and, you know, many of these kind of supply shortage issues, what happened was that supply in 2018 has kind of crept up unexpectedly on markets. Now, I say unexpectedly, paying attention, it seemed obvious to some of us, but nonetheless, what slide 4 shows on the left is that, in fact, world liquids have increased almost 3.5 million barrels so far in 2018. This data is through October and comes from mostly EIA STEO, but is corroborated from other sources. And where is that oil coming from? We know that OPEC, particularly Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the UAE, have been pushing very hard to increase production, and they have. But the graph on the right shows that, yeah, some of it's coming from the usual sources, OPEC, Russia, United States, but a lot of it is coming from what's labeled as rest of world, which is, you know, sort of everybody else. And so what the graph on the right shows is that just since May, world liquid supply has increased almost 3 million barrels a day. So supply is robust. And what it suggests is that it's kind of simple. If you raise oil prices, guess what? That provides an incentive for people to drill, and if they drill more, they produce more. It's kind of basic economics. And so somehow markets in their obsession with where we might be short, and don't get me wrong, we will be short sometime very soon in the near future for all the reasons we can go into, lack of investment, et cetera, et cetera. But for right now, as I've been saying, certainly since mid-year, the world is well supplied with oil. And guess what? The comparative inventory yield curve says, yeah, we told you so. So that's really where we're at on supply.
Art, it sounds like you're saying that for the moment we're well supplied, but you think at some point we're going to be short again. And that's very much been on my mind, because I think someday this shale oil phenomenon is going to play out. And once it does, there aren't a lot of alternatives to turn to. So as we look at the forecast here, how much confidence do you have in the official forecasts, and where do you think things are ultimately headed?
Well, that's a great question, Eric, and the answer is I don't trust anybody's forecasts, including my own, so I think that kind of says it all. But having said that, this is what we have. I mean, this is the best information we have for now. So most of what you're looking at in the two graphs on slide 5 has already happened, okay? So, I mean, everything through certainly the third quarter of this year and fourth quarter is, you know, is not that much of a stretch. So, you know, really 85% of what you're seeing has already happened. And so the rest, of course, is speculative. But what I'm showing here on the left, this is a combination of OPEC and EIA data. I use EIA simply because it's the only agency that forecasts supply forward. IEA and OPEC just forecast demand. And what this shows is that we have actually, the world has entered a supply surplus beginning in fourth quarter, which of course just began a couple of weeks ago. That surplus is anticipated to increase to a fairly whopping 1.5 million barrels a day by the second quarter of 2019, and then decrease again, approaching balance. So, as you said in your question, and as I said to Patrick on the last slide, the world is well supplied with oil now. That doesn't mean that we're going to be well supplied for the future very far, because our options become more and more limited and more expensive as we go forward. And that's kind of what the slide on the left is saying, that we'll reach a surplus maximum about mid-year, maybe, if you believe it, and then get back to balance. And then, you know, who knows what's going to happen in 2020, but my suspicion is that it won't be that far off into the future, assuming the economy doesn't crater, today being a great day to to question whether that's in fact going to happen or not, but we'll leave that there. You know, sometime in the very near future, 2020, 2021, who knows, we will start to feel real supply tightness. But the final point I want to make on this is the second graph. I've averaged through all of these quarterly data points, partly to smooth out the uncertainty going forward. And what I'm showing here then is just a kind of period averages of supply growth. And so this is a little bit scary, if you want to know the truth, because what it shows is that the surplus that we are identifying right now seems to have really begun in the very early part of 2018, when we thought, gee, you know, now we're finally out of the woods on the oil price collapse and oversupply, and everything's going to get better from now on. And of course, it shows it, you know, lasting through the length of the forecast through 2019. But the part that's a little scary is the magnitude of this thing is not a whole lot lower than what put us into, you know, full oil price collapse just a matter of 4 years ago or so in the latter part of 2014. And interestingly, that surplus began developing in the very early part of 2014. It took markets about 6 months to start to figure that out and see a price response, and it was a good 9 months later that we actually saw the price collapse. So I'm not saying that that's going to happen this time, but it's just kind of a creepy coincidence. Let's just put it that way. So that's where the data suggests we are, which again is to say, oil price WTI realistically should be 55 to 60 and Brent should be 60 to 65 or 70, and that part of it doesn't surprise me. The fact that we've gone somewhat lower, I suspect and I hope will adjust its way back to equilibrium before too long. But again, that's barring some larger financial problem that, you know, so far is unclear.
Something else I want to point out, Art, on the bottom of the slide is artberman.com, because that's where your blog is, and it is one of the very best free resources that I know on the internet. You're constantly posting blog posts. The blog is completely free. There's no subscription fee, and it's the same quality of graphs and charts that we see here. Before I let you go, though, you are going to be joining us on January 19th in Vancouver, BC, Canada, for our second Macro Voices live event. What are you going to be speaking to us about?
I'm going to be speaking principally on the themes that we've touched here toward the end, which is kind of looking at oil supply and price from both sides. The short term, which looks like we'll be, you know, still talking about oversupply in January when we're together in Vancouver, which, by the way, I'm really looking forward to. Should be really exciting to be among the kind of speakers and guests that you'll have there. But I really do want to keep us focused on where we're going. And where we're going is ultimately a potential supply crisis, which will put us in a whole different scenario with not only oil prices, but global economics. So that will be the theme and the subject of what I want to talk about in Vancouver, Eric.
Well, we look forward to seeing you in Vancouver, and you'll have plenty of opportunity to network with our attendees. One of the biggest things we got out of Toronto is people wanted more FaceTime with the speakers. So we've got two receptions instead of one. Plenty of opportunity for our speakers and attendees to get to know one another while enjoying a cocktail and the view from the top floor of the Hyatt, which of course overlooks the spectacular waterline there in Vancouver. So Art, we'll see you in Vancouver.
All right, Eric and Patrick, it's always great to talk to you, and really, really looking forward to getting together and speaking with your other guests and, of course, all the attendees. So thanks for the invitation, and see you there.
And speaking of Vancouver, I want to give all of our listeners a quick update. We did have early on some problems with the Hyatt. It seems to all have been reserved now. We have noticed that there's quite a few of you that have reserved your tickets for Macro Voices Live, but have not booked yet at the Hyatt. Please be assured those problems should be resolved by now. If you do have any difficulty, please email us and we'll get to the bottom of it right away. In any case, the link for booking your reservations at the Hyatt, and you can arrive as early as the 14th of January and leave as late as the 24th and still qualify for our discounted group rates for your entire stay. That link is at macrovoices.com/live where it says book the Hyatt. So hopefully all of the problems we had early on have all been resolved. And on that note, we're going to wrap the show up here for this week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup email.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the links to Jeffrey's supporting articles. You'll also find a chart book that Art Berman was referencing throughout the post-game interview. You'll also find an interesting blog post from Variant Perception titled The Italian Doom Loop, and an interesting article from the South China Morning Post suggesting China is underestimating its $3 trillion debt. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.